ओम नमो भागवते वासुदेवाय।
ओम नमो भागवते वासुदेवाय।
ओम नमो भागवते वासुदेवाय।
ओम नमो भागवते वासुदेवाय।
नारायण नमस्तु जन नारायण शायदं नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं जय मुदीरये नस्तत्रयेषु भवद्रेषु नित्यं भगवतः सेवाया भागवती रामश्लोकेन लोके भवति नैष्ठिकी। We're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, translations and purports by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. First Canto, 19th chapter, text number 39.
Nunam Bhagavato Brahman.
It is said that you hardly stay in the houses of men long enough to milk a cow. Translation and response. O powerful Brahman.
O powerful Brahman.
It is said that you hardly stay in the houses of men
long enough to milk a cow.
Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Saints and sages, in the renounced order of life, go to the houses of the householders at the time they milk their cows, early in the morning, and ask some quantity of milk for subsistence. A pound of milk, fresh from the milk bag of a cow, is sufficient to feed an adult with all vitamin values, and therefore saints and sages live only on milk. Even the poorest of the householders keep at least 10 cows, each delivering 12 to 20 quarts of milk, and therefore no one hesitates to spare a few pounds of milk for the mendicants. It is a duty of householders to maintain the saints and sages like the children. So a saint like Shukadeva Goswami would hardly stay at the house of a householder for more than 5 minutes in the morning. In other words, such saints are very rarely seen in the houses of householders, and Maharaj Parikshit therefore prayed to him to instruct him as soon as possible. The householders also should be intelligent enough to get some transcendental information from visiting sages. The householder should not foolishly ask a saint to deliver what is available in the market. That should be the reciprocal relation between the saints and householders.
Chakshurunmunitam jena tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chaitanya manovisvam sthapitam jena bhutale svayam rupakramayam dadati svadhantikam.
I think I'll read the last verse in this canto. We'll finish the chapter.
Sutta uvacha eva mabhashita prishta saragya Shakshnaya Patya Vashatata Mogyo Bhagavan Badarayani.
Sri Sukta Goswami said, the king thus spoke and questioned the sages using smooth language. Thus the great and powerful personality, the son of Vyasadeva, who knew the principles of religion, began his reply. This is a very commonly held understanding that the great sages stay in the homes of the householders only for the length of time it takes them to milk the cow, and I suppose deliver the milk and to drink it. Or maybe they just take it away, I don't know. Maybe they're takeaways. Prabhupada mentions that there should be a reciprocal relationship between the saints and the householders. That is, the duty of the householder is to get information from the saints and sages and to care for them, to care for their subsistence. That's part of the system of Varnashram or Taiji Varnashram. Everyone is in their rightful position, and saints, the elderly, women and children, the Brahmins, they're meant to be protected and looked after. So this is a duty of the householder, Grihamidinam of the householders, as said in Sanskrit. So it's that custom wherever there's a remnant of Varnashram in India. We see the wandering about of sages knocking on doors. In Kali Yuga, it's become, Prabhupada has mentioned something of a business that people go from door to door to live, and they're not exchanging, they're not giving spiritual enlightenment, or maybe they're flattering some wealthy household so that they can go live there or have great wealth. So that system has broken down and has become perverted. In an earlier text, in that purport, Prabhupada says that to flatter such persons and to take money from them for some unrenounced order of life is worse than death. So he's giving some warnings that in this age of Kali, everything is very perverted, and in a particular dress or under a particular status of life, people are abusing their privileges, they're exploiting others, and they're not carrying on in a proper way. Prabhupada has also been very disdainful in his writings about people who don't live honestly, but in the name of preaching, they set up a little temple and they get subscriptions from people, and they have a little deity of some kind. It may be a Vishnu deity, it may be a Ganesh deity, it may be a Lakshmi or Durga deity, and they make their living that way. So there are corrupted people who are sannyasis, there are corrupted people who are grihasthas or grihamedis, and in every type of so-called ashram or every type of varna or status of life, almost in Kali Yuga, everything has become perverted, everything has become exploitative, everything has become unnatural, irregular, and as Prabhupada uses the term topsy-turvy, we have people who are sutra mentalities running the governments as kshatriyas, and we have the people who are very well educated and very brahminical out fixing fences and doing agricultural work. So in the age of Kali, things are topsy-turvy, but again, above all of the different types of varnas and ashrams, one should become a Vaishnava. That is imperative, that one becomes a Vaishnava, which is superior to being even a Brahmin. That one should understand what the philosophy of life is. So Lord Chaitanya is famous for saying that he's not a sannyasi, he's not a householder, keeper, leaper, keeper, nyasi. He's not any of these distinctions, but he is a devotee of the Lord. So the devotee of the Lord is above all distinctions. Nonetheless, Srila Prabhupada said that he wanted us to not be dependent upon the things of Kali Yuga, which make Kali Yuga very exceptional and very pronounced, very prominent in this day and age. And as I was seeing how you have such a very wonderful farm here, it's a great blessing to have this, because at some point, people are going to respect such living. Actually, not even at some point, but even now, people are very concerned about living in a more natural way. People are very aware that we're not living in a natural way, and we're not giving proper credence to people who are in their renounced order of life. We're ruining our environment and so on. So, in these kinds of settings, there will be great interest on the part of the public at large to see a community that is not dependent upon petroleum or electricity. There are a few. There's one in Hungary, there's one in a couple in Brazil, there's a few developing here and there. And people are very, very interested. They flock to these places to see how is it possible to live without electric lights? How is it possible to live without computers? How is it possible to live without cars? So, if you have your own water supply, if you have your own food supply, if you're not dependent on the market, and if you're not dependent upon what the state gives you, and there's great, great interest in this. Very, very great interest. So we shouldn't think that living in a self-sufficient way is not preaching. It is actually one of the best kinds of preaching there is, because people will flock to such things to see how people can live such a way. There's a community not far from where I'm based in Washington. There's a community called the Amish. I think they were originally a Dutch Mennonite group. And they don't live completely self-sufficient, but they don't have cars. They ride in horses and buggies. And they're very disdainful about electricity. And they're near our Gianagri community, actually. They're in the same area. And the devotees in Gianagri have learned a lot from them about self-sufficiency and farming. And they're very famous, actually, in the United States. People go to their community and see how they can live without the usual things that cushion us and make life very easy for us. It's very hard. When I was at the Banner, I remember Prabhupada was talking about how difficult it was. We were trying to get devotees to come to New Vrindavan to slow things. And he was explaining to us, and we came to understand it ourselves, that it's actually very difficult for those of us who are used to going to the store and buying things and driving cars to grow our own food and to be without cars and electricity. It's very, very difficult because we're very, more than we realize, we're very urbanized and cityfied. And to live next to land is very, very difficult. It takes some time. It takes decades or generations to develop a sense of really working the land and making your own clothes, making your own papers. So, turning back the clock, like 150 or 200 years, very, very difficult. But actually, Prabhupada, because he had the vision to see what would happen in the next few hundred years, saw that this is what he wanted in his larger communities where there was lots of land. So this is not only what Prabhupada wanted, but it's part of preaching. It's part of Yagidam Paramam Guyam Adbhaktes Chavidashiti. It's part of expanding the circle of Krishna consciousness. It's very, frontline preaching, we might say. So it's a very good opportunity, and I feel very privileged to be part of this community, even though it's only very temporary, because the future of much of what Prabhupada wanted in Krishna consciousness lies in communities like this, with lots of acreage and the ability to grow your own food and make your own milk and live next to the land in a more natural way. More natural way of living, which is what Krishna consciousness actually is, isn't it? It's a more natural way of living. The way that people live now is very unnatural. It's very artificial. As Prabhupada says in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, that we've made great advances in transportation and communications and on and science and medical science. But there's a pinprick in a social body at large. It's a very interesting word. People are realizing it's artificial. A gentleman came to speak to us named Howard Lyman, who was a third or fourth generation Montana cattle rancher. And he's now a leading spokesman advocate for vegetarianism. But he was explaining how after about being maybe, I don't know, away from the farm for a long time, he went back to visit his farm. And he remembers when he was a child, before agribusiness set in, that the soil was very rich, and when you would pick it up in your hands, there would be little claws and lots of worms. And when he went back to see it, after all these years of artificial fertilizer and increasing the herd by thousands of cows, that the soil was very sandy, And there were no worms in it, and it was all very changed. So this is what has happened due to the artificial kind of civilization that we've been living in. Two farms, something like 70 or 80,000 of these family farms are going out of business every year. So it's a very unnatural kind of situation that we're living in. So to return to a more natural situation is essential, and Prabhupada coined the phrase simple living and high thinking. We should live in a very simple way, but we should think philosophy. We should think theology. We should think very deeply about what the purpose of life is, what the purpose of a human being is. Prabhupada was speaking in Los Angeles in about 1974, and he was talking about how part of this artificial civilization is that we try to invent and discover things ourselves and come to conclusions. But, and he was talking to a group of scholars in his garden, who may have seen some pictures in LA, and they were talking about the way that we can understand God intellectually. And Prabhupada was spending some time explaining to them that actually we can't understand Krishna from an intellectual point of view. But that's very limited. Not that we don't apply our own minds, but that we can't actually gain complete understanding, because as he was explaining, there are three types of perception. Pratyaksha or pratyaksha, by direct perception, which is how we try to understand everything nowadays. By anuma, by thinking, by hypotheses, by speculation, and by hearing, or by shabda. And he was explaining that when Krishnadas Kaviraj was writing, for example, the Chaitanya Chaitamrita, which we're reading the summary, the end of every chapter, he pays his obeisances to Rukha and Raghunath, his predecessor gurus, and he's saying that it's by his mercy only that I'm able to write the Chaitanya Chaitamrita. And Prabhupada comments on one of the verses in the Chaitanya Chaitamrita that one shouldn't write out of vanity or try to surpass the previous acharya, but one should write out of order. One is given the order to write, whether it's published or not, if the acharyas, if the predecessor gurus and spiritual masters give the order, make the request that someone should put something in writing, then it should be done. So, Krishnadas Kaviraj has explained that when he was very old, and we know he was writing when he was racked with pain, he couldn't even sit properly, he had to stand most of the time, and he said he didn't even know how he was doing it, but by the mercy and the order of his spiritual masters, he was seeing his hand was moving, and the pen and the stylus whatever he was writing with was making words on the paper or palm leaves. So that is the notion of a Vaishnava. Not that we create our own thing, but that we're operating by the mercy of the previous acharyas. So in this way, when the sages come to visit, or we have the opportunity to associate with them somehow, we should take great advantage and put questions to them. And as we put questions to them with great eagerness, as Maharaj Parikit was doing with Shukadeva Goswami, then the speaker becomes very enlivened to deliver the message, because the hearer is very eager to hear. So Shukadeva is the perfect speaker, personification of speaking, of speech, of kirtanam, and Maharaj Parikit is the perfect recipient. He's very eager to hear. He's the personification of hearing. So these are essential, that we become very eager, very enthusiastic to hear. Utsahan is chayatraya. The first principle, the six symptoms of manifesting, tips, you might say, from Rupa Goswami and Upadesha Amrita, is Utsahan, is to be very eager, to be very enthusiastic in Krishna consciousness. One should not just go to the Bhagavatam class because it is a duty, but enthusiasm means that one should run to the Bhagavatam class. Should be very eager and very happy to hear things. You're writing things down if necessary, and absorbing all that is being said. Because these are the words of Krishna, actually. When Krishnadas Kaviraj was writing, he was a transparent medium. He was just a conduit, putting down on paper what was coming from the disciple succession. So eagerness is very important. Utsanish chayataraya. Eagerness, great enthusiasm, confidence, and of course patience. Krishna will deliver when he wants to, not when we necessarily want our spiritual emancipation to be delivered. It will come as Krishna wants us to do it. So Rupa Goswami is very dear to us because he's giving so many directions, so many little tips and hints. And as I was mentioning the other day, when Prabhupada was looking out the window of his room, his eating room, and seeing the samadhis of Rupa Goswami and the Vajan Kutir of Rupa Goswami, he was feeling very inspired. to get the mercy of these great souls. It's not that he was creating something out of nothing, but he was passing down Krishna consciousness as it was given to him, as he realized it to these great saints. So this, of course, is not generally recommended, sannyasa in this age of Kali, nor is the sacrifice of a horse or a cow or flesh of the forefathers or impregnating one's wife or one's brother. These are five prohibitions that are given in Chaitanya Chaitanya in Kali Yuga. But in order to get his movement started, Prabhupada gave a few people that status of life. But again, it shouldn't be considered that it's so special, because all the devotees are very special. And Prabhupada wrote once a letter to a devotee who wanted to leave his wife kind of prematurely, and he said that living with a very beautiful and obedient wife is much superior to being sannyas. So in this age of Kali, where everything is not what it appears to be, a great saintly person can be in any garb or in any status of life, and it's imperative that we learn from all such devotees. So we should take advantage whenever they visit. There needs to be a great reciprocity. Of course, the Varnashram Dharma, Daivi Varnashram system, as Prabhupada said, to be established would take some time, and it would be coming in the future. We were talking a little yesterday, and I promised to continue some of Prabhupada's reflections on Jesus Christ and Christmas and spreading Krishna consciousness in the Christian world, the world of Christendom. So I thought we'd continue a little with that. One of the quotes that I brought forward yesterday was that Prabhupada was asked in a conversation in a room about what is the goal of a Christian who follows Christ. And Prabhupada's answer to that was that there's a Svargaloka place in one of the higher planetary systems where Lord Jesus Christ resides, and his followers can go there. But out of the 1,152 some odd references to Jesus Christ, I happen to find this one, which is a little bit different. And this was in a public lecture, which is also, in one sense, more important than a private conversation, because Prabhupada was speaking in a public way, was aware that these things might be brought out in a more public way. So this was in Los Angeles on the 3rd of January, 1969. Prabhupada was commenting on the Bhagavad Gita in the 4th chapter. And at the end of the lecture, a devotee asked him, "Does Lord Jesus Christ appear in a spiritual sky with the body he manifested on the earth?" Prabhupada, "Yes. Otherwise, how can there be resurrection? Ordinary body cannot be resurrected. He appeared in his spiritual body, certainly. Jesus Christ told, if I remember, that Lord excused these persons who are crucifying him. Is it not? He knew, quote, these rascals are killing me, but they are offending, certainly. So they do not know that I cannot be killed, but they are thinking that they are killing. You see?" And this, end of the quote. "But that was offensive. Therefore, he begged the Lord to be excused, because God cannot excuse to the offenders of the devotee. He can excuse one who is offended to God, but if someone is offended to the devotee, God never excuses. And he could not be killed. That he knew. But those rascals, they thought they were killing Jesus Christ." So there are many, many, many references. In the books, we only found a couple of hundred, but in the lectures, there's 300 or 400. In the conversations, there's 400 or 500 more. So there's many, many things. So I'm just making this point to show that sometimes we can sort of take a quote out of what Prabhupada said somewhere and think that that's the answer, that's the be-all and the end-all, and that's the final summary of everything that Prabhupada said. Sometimes, because it may be a later time in Prabhupada's time, and that's usually more important. But it's a symbol of something that we tend to do, and that is to quote very selectively to back up our own notions, and they may not be really what Prabhupada said. So to be comprehensive and to be thorough, to be faithful to real scholarship, and to try to get a sense of what the inner meaning of what Prabhupada thought about many things is not just to take a few things, but to look at everything, and not just necessarily the words like Jesus Christ, but we might have to look at many other contextual types of words like Christianity and religion and the West and so on, and really at some point, it will probably have to be written what Prabhupada's views were on a lot of different things based on very deep and thorough, exhaustive kind of research. And that is really intellectual honesty, not just sort of taking something that we like or a few things that we like or assimilating a kind of superficial, unscholarly version of what we thought that Prabhupada said. So, to be alert mentally and not intellectually dishonest, this kind of research has to be done. It's not going to be done overnight, but it will be done over time. But disciplines of this nature are being developed, and people are beginning to research and write on these topics. It will require a lot of time and training, but it's en route. So I sort of promised I was going to read a little bit about, this is an interesting topic about the famous lost years of Jesus Christ. There was a period from, I think, when he was about 13 to 30 that's not documented or not well documented. And Prabhupada said that he was in India at some point. And there are temples actually named after him in South India to the Saint Isha, according to what some scholars have unearthed. And some say that his body was exhumed and went to Kashmir and preached there. There's a lot of different ideas about what happened during those years. But since this is a Christian country, I thought that I might read a little bit from some research that was done by Satyaraj Das called Did Jesus Go to India? Is that okay? Is that all right? Okay. I want to get permission from the lecturer before launching into anything during the Bhagavatam class. Yeah, there's not a resounding no, so I'm going to be here. This is a quote from Matthew. He starts out, as lightning comes out of the east and shines directed to the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. What did Jesus Christ do from the time he was 12 to the age of 30? We are aware of his miraculous birth. The Bible also records the famous temple scenario at age 12. Then we are reintroduced to him at age 30, being baptized at the River Jordan. With all due respect for his accomplishments after that, we are left with 18 years unaccounted for. Unimportant? Quite the contrary. If we are to accept that Jesus Christ changed the face of the earth in a 3-year ministry, and he did, then 18 missing years becomes vitally important. In the life of a person who is considered God incarnate by many, and at least a great saint by others, every moment is valuable, every gesture is instructive, every pastime is precious. We were talking about this the other day. I know all of you weren't here, but I read from a paper that Dr. Thomas Hopkins wrote about how the theology of Christian consciousness would be more complete and emerge when for lack of a better word, the Gospels of Krishna consciousness, in addition to the actual recorded words of Prabhupada, are presented. In Christianity, we have the Gospels of Mark, Luke, Matthew, and then there's the one of John. They, together with the Bible, became the theology kind of Christianity. So there are a number of memoirs of Sutsrup Goswami, Maharaja Parisori, and there will be many, many others that will come forth. And all together, they will form a more thorough and complete body of knowledge in addition to what we have now. As the written, the recorded words for Shubha, we'll have the sworn statements of the eyewitnesses of what Prabhupada did, what he said, how he acted, how he responded to various things. But the Bible is silent about the missing years. Since 1947, a veritable storehouse of scrolls and fragments have been discovered at the Dead Sea in Israel and in Hamadi in Egypt. While these discoveries did shed some new light on the first century Palestine and biblical culture in general, they had very little to say about the lost years, quote-unquote, of Jesus, as the 18 years had come to be called. I won't read all of this because it's a bit long, but just to give you a little taste of it. Still, the newly discovered manuscript served to illuminate our understanding of innovation and interpolation of Western religious literature, especially in regard to non-canonical works known as the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha. What is that? How's that pronounced? I don't know. I'm not familiar with that one. These were officially considered heretical by Roman Church, but were originally part of the Christian literary tradition. Through the Dead Sea and Nag Hammadi finds, scholars became aware and organized Christendom was highly selective in its promulgation of transcendental truth. There was much the Church was keeping from us, and we wanted to know all the details. Thus, many began to consider the 18 missing years of Jesus. Books by theologians, religionists, and independent researchers inundated the market. Reverend C.R. Potter, for instance, released an informative book in 1962, The Lost Years of Jesus Revealed. Scholars Anne Reed and Jay Hurst informed the world of Edgar Cayce's work in this area by each publishing their own fascinating book on the subject. In 1976, Andreas Faber Kaiser contributed his special, exceptional work, Jesus Died in Kashmir, which not only thoroughly explained what happened during the 18 missing years, but also postulated a convincing and revolutionary theory of what transpired after the crucifixion. When Jesus was taken down from the cross, we will return to this Kashmir hypothesis later. And perhaps the most recent work of Jesus' 18 missing years is by Elizabeth Clare Prophet, whose comprehensive book, The Lost Years of Jesus, deals with every nuance of the subject. It should be noted furthermore that all of the above researchers, among others whom we shall soon mention, have found to their satisfaction that Jesus did indeed travel to India. Reverend Potter, however, was more inclined to believe that Jesus' 18 missing years were spent among the Essenes. Nonetheless, even the Reverend is ready to admit that the time may have been divided between studying with the Essenes and the journey to India. The most famous contemporary work about Jesus' travels, however, comes from a husband and wife team, Dick and Janet Bond, whose painstaking research bore fruit in a film, The Lost Years, and a book, The Jesus Mystery. The Lost Years is 1978, and The Jesus Mystery is 1980. Maybe some of you have read these books and seen some of these videos. Anyone? I saw The Lost Years. I think Richard Bach is a disciple of Sai Baba. Just a little side note. The great thing dawned on us that those years were missing because someone had taken them out of the records, out of the Bible. We could not imagine Jesus would have appeared in Galilee at the age of 30 and hidden a major part of his life from the disciples he loved and asked to follow him. And it really doesn't seem possible. Those years were so unimportant as to be dismissed without a word. So the idea grew at some point that what had been known about those years in his life had been deleted. In examining historical records of the early Christian church, it became evident that the early Christian councils, especially the First Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, changed many points of doctrine. Those missing years were expunged because they did not coincide with the political needs of a growing church. Research in the last 4 years by the Box and others mentioned above unveiled a controversy obscured since the latter part of the last century and the early part of this one. This controversy about Jesus' travels in India began in 1894 when a Russian journalist, Nikolai Notovich, published a mysterious and provocative book entitled The Unknown Life of Jesus Christ. Just after the Turco-Russian War, it seems, Notovich began a journey to the Orient. By 1887, he arrived in Kashmir, where he had heard of a Buddhist convent in Leh, the capital of Ladakh. Out of curiosity, and perhaps providence, he decided to visit the monks of Leh. There he was told an ancient document. The lama in charge was quite secretive, but he did reveal that the document was about the life of Saint Issa, I-S-S-A. The Latin spelling of Jesus is I-E-S-U-S. Jesus. In Arabic, it is Isha, or Issa. It should be mentioned, moreover, that Isa is a Sanskrit word, I think it's Isha, for the word Ishvara, the Indian name for God, literally meaning the supreme controller. In the ancient Pali manuscripts, Notovich was told, were to be found in the palace of the ancient Pali manuscripts, Notovich was told, were to be found in the palace of the Dalai Lama, and these were even copies of older Sanskrit versions. Copies existed in several Buddhist monasteries along the countryside. Notovich realized that he was fortunate enough to be at one of these monasteries. The desire to see these scrolls now becoming an obsession, Notovich offered the head lama 3 gifts, an alarm clock, a watch, and a thermometer. hoping that the Buddhist priest would be so kind as to show him the life of St. Isa in return. No luck. As he was leaving the monastery, Navratilovich hurt his leg in a riding accident and was forced to return, much to his good fortune. At his bedside, the chief lama, now taking care of him, finally unveiled two great volumes in cardboard covers. This, the lama thought, would make the weary Russian traveler happy. Indeed it did. Here, written on decaying leaves, was the biography of St. Isa. Novovich's leg quickly healed, but not before he could secure an interpreter for the Isa manuscript. Noting down the story, word for word, Novovich soon returned to the West and published The Unknown Life of Jesus Christ. The book informs us that at age 13, Jesus left the home of Mary and Joseph in Nazareth. He traveled with a merchant caravan to the holy cities of India and even to the sacred Ganges River. Later, he left for Europe to penetrate the mysteries of the Great Pyramid. And heading back, he explored the diverse philosophies of Athens and Persepolis. He returned to Israel when he was 25, 18 years later. It should be noted that Levi H. Dowling's popular book, The Aquarian Gospel, is known to be derived from Notovich's work, published in 1908, just 14 years after Notovich published The Unknown Life. Levi claimed his book was a psychic document given to him by revelation. Naturally, the academic world was skeptical and claimed it was simply plagiarism. With a few embellishments and Levi's personal beliefs infiltrating the book, it largely tells the same story as Notovich's authoritative work. According to the ancient manuscript found by Notovich, Jesus spent 6 years learning and teaching the scriptures of India, the Vedas, in Jagannath Puri, Benares, and other cities in the state of Orissa. It was there that his philosophy began to take shape. Although he found great value in Vedic knowledge, he saw how such knowledge could be misused. For instance, the Brahmin priests, the intellectual class, were exploiting the lower classes, especially the Shudras, teaching that the knowledge of the Vedas was only for the upper crust. Jesus found this repugnant. Love of God was for every man, woman, and child. Jesus then took it upon himself to rectify the situation, and he began teaching Vedic knowledge to the Shudras. Thus he began his activities as a religious reformer, which would make history as he applied it when he returned to the West. There, the Pharisees were teaching a legalistic religion. Jesus reminded them of the spirit behind the law. In Notovich's work, too, we see Jesus warning the caste-conscious Brahmins that they have forgotten the true teachings of the Vedas. To be sure, the Vedas taught the principle of class distinction, but this was originally according to qualifications and work. In Orissa, at the time, the whole concept had become distorted, and people were claiming caste rights according to birthright. One was born in a Brahmin family. He was considered a Brahmin, even if he lacked the necessary qualifications, such as cleanliness, austerity, mercy, and truthfulness. Jesus sought to put an end to this hypocrisy. The original Vedic idea, however, was fully accepted by Jesus, and history relates how he incorporated these ideas when he returned to Palestine. Every human being, Jesus taught, should worship God according to his capacity and work. This concept is decidedly Vedic, wherein everyone, according to his capacity and work, fit into particular categories or castes naturally. And these castes were considered equal in that they facilitated a particular kind of service to the Supreme. Some fit into the intellectual caste, Brahman. Others administrative, Kshatriya. Some are inclined toward mercantile activity, Vaishya, while others fit into the working class category, Shudra, but all are equal in the eyes of God. No wonder, therefore, we find Jesus castigating the Brahmins for the misrepresentation of Vedic knowledge. They were not actually Brahmins, at least not by qualification and spiritual understanding. Indeed, the British would soon criticize the caste system 1900 years later for a similar reason. Either due to pure ignorance or impure motivation, the Brahmins of Orissa plotted against Jesus' life, again indicating that they were not actually Brahmins. It is against the rabbinical code to kill in any way, shape, or form whatsoever. This is extended to the point that most Brahmins are strict vegetarians. After several unsuccessful attempts on the life of Jesus, we find the Master fleeing Jagannath Puri, never to return again. This Isa story informs us that after escaping, Jesus journeyed to Nepal, deep into the Himalayas. There he spent another 6 years teaching the science of spirituality. Onward to Persia, where he preached against the concept of two gods, one of good and one of evil, denouncing the concept as a primitive form of polytheism. Polytheism, I think you pronounce it. Jesus was not well received by the Zoroastrians, who believed in the battle between the two gods. There is only one God, Jesus, he said, taught. and that is our Father in Heaven. The next part of the Isa manuscript, and this, and thus Novavich's book, is almost exactly the same as the Bible account with which we are so familiar, complete with Pontius Pilate, the crucifixion, and the apostles. Thus, what the ancient Buddhist manuscript offers is a possible explanation of Jesus' activities during the 18 missing years, of which the Bible says nothing. At this point, most readers will probably maintain their initial skepticism. After all, except for the word of a Buddhist monk and a Russian traveler, there is no concrete evidence that the manuscript actually exists, or that its contents are true. What's more, most readers are probably unsure as to whether travel between Palestine and India was possible in those days. Furthermore, and perhaps most importantly, just why should Jesus want to go to India anyway? These are the subjects we shall now discuss. Shall I carry on? While it may be difficult to ascertain the authenticity and validity of the Isa manuscript, it is not possible, it is not impossible. In fact, even the Church's attitude on the subject is enlightening. When confronted with the subject by Novavich, they backed off, sometimes opposing arguments and other times simply ignoring his work. They always seemed careful, and if they had something, as if they had something to hide, some secret to protect. According to Elizabeth Clare Prophet, Cardinal Rotelli opposed Notovich's work because he felt it was, quote, premature, end quote, that the world was not ready to hear it. Quote, the Church suffers already too much from the new wave of atheistical thought, Rotelli told Notovich. The Cardinal was obviously fearful of losing followers who were already skeptical of Church doctrine. They needed another obstacle to overcome. I probably shouldn't continue too long because I think there are many duties to be attended to. And while it's all very interesting and nice, I think that it's available to read for those of you who want to pursue it. There's not, there's a few more pages, but I probably shouldn't continue here. So, what should I do? Should I maybe 5 minutes for questions for page 20 now? Okay. So, we can have a bit of 5 minutes for interactive activity. Yeah. Krishnandu.
I was just looking at the Amish community. It seems that there's more to a community than just living without electricity. And what are some of the things that they do to help build the community spirit?
Well, I've never visited them, so I don't know. But as to the question is, it takes more than just self-sufficiency to make a community work. Obviously, it takes many things. Mennonites or Amish, they've been living in these communities for many, many years, over 100 years, maybe 200 years or more. They are people who kind of know each other. This is a very deep question, actually. What makes a community work? The Christian is actually at the center. Should be outlawed. So that's on a kind of person-to-person discussion. But as far as communities, the imperative is that we have to make them work, and it's not easy. Just like it's not easy sometimes for two people to live together for the rest of their lives. But the Christian, as I said, is at the center. Even though people may not be accustomed to various community life or living with people who are different from them, they need to, because it's Prabhupada's desire and Krishna is to be at the center of our lives, to make it work. So we come together, we worship the deity together, we do service together, we cook together, we preach together, and by working shoulder to shoulder, by keeping Krishna in the center, a community can actually come into existence and be a strong community. Now, there are many people who try living in communities. They try to form new communities in different parts of the world. And in general, they have not been successful because there hasn't been a spiritual basis to their communities. They just try and fail. Dozens, maybe hundreds of such communities. We know of them in the States. I don't know, there's probably many here. There's many in England and other places. They try to live a simple life. They try to be self-sufficient, but they couldn't get along. They kept forming factions and political groups, and therefore they were unable to last. So it's a great test of our ability to be Krishna conscious, to form communities that are vital and working, and satisfying to Srila Prabhupada. So he established, he was the one who wanted such communities to come into existence. He visited such communities, he preached in such communities, and he said that these have to be here forever, and we have to become independent of the material world. So we need to form very strong bonds and whatever is necessary to make communities work. They have to support each other in different ways, and it may be difficult, but as has been often said, if the roof is leaking, we try to fix the roof. We don't go to someone else's house. It's our house. This community is our community. And if there's problems, we should fix them. We should do what's necessary to make them work, but not try to just abandon them and go away. So this is the challenge that's before us. So when I say it's a very deep question, I say it's not an easy thing. There are many challenges that come up, many difficulties that will arise, and often they're on a very personal level. But such things need to actually be overcome, and we need to say in a very simplistic way, quote, make it work, end quote. That's what Prabhupada wants to do. And one of the things he said once was that when, especially leaders, but all devotees, when they experience difficulties, they should discuss it threadbare until they can come to a deeper understanding. So this is necessary to understand why we are here and what makes us tick and what a community is and what we need to do and how we need to act and how we need to resolve our conflicts. And this is what Prabhupada would do. I think our meditation is often what Prabhupada said once to someone, maybe at a certain time or a certain place. But our meditation really should be that Prabhupada is sitting right there. He's here. Or right here. He's sitting somewhere. He's worshiping those deities. And our meditation should be, what would Prabhupada say? How would he act? What would he do if he were here right now, at this time, with us? And he is. But we should be conscious. As we're Krishna conscious, we should be Prabhupada conscious also. And think, what would he say? What would he do? How would he answer that question? I'm trying to give my little answer. But I'm also trying to think, what would Prabhupada say? And this is what we have to think when we encounter this very difficult question of what makes community work. Not an easy thing, but this is how we have to see it, in my view.
Remembering you mentioned two religions, Christianity and Hinduism, and both of them believe in one supreme force and one world, then wouldn't we consider Jesus to be a form of Krishna or Vishnu as such? Because, I mean, if you have two religions, but if you believe in one force of life, wouldn't Jesus just be another form of Krishna to preach them with the same word?
Yeah. Well, there's misunderstandings both in Hinduism and Christianity. Most Hindus think there is a Krishna, but they don't think he's the supreme being in person. They have a sense that Narayana, or the impersonal aspect of Krishna, is superior to Krishna. So that understanding isn't complete, and it's not truly monotheistic in the sense that most Hindus have many gods. They have a pantheon, they have a Durga, they have a Lakshmi, and they're not really sure. And in Christianity, we have a kind of conflict set up, or an uncertainty about whether Jesus is God or whether Jesus is the Son of God, because both things are said, and people are very muddled about this. Most Christians can't really answer that question properly. Is Jesus the Son of God or is he God? And they kind of say, well, he's sort of both things, we're not really sure. And it's unclear. But we can take it that Jesus was the Son of God, that he was a great saint, as is mentioned here, and as Prabhupada's many, many references point out, he was a great reformer. And he was the Son of God. Prabhupada called him the best son, and represented a great saint or a great sage, but not God himself. Sometimes people even think that Prabhupada is God, or that Subhadeva Goswami is God, because he had a blue hue to his body. But these are representatives of God. They're great sages, and they point to God. But God is, in Christianity, God is the Father. And Jesus Christ was always saying that God is the Father. But it has become, in this age of Kali, misinterpreted and misconstrued that sometimes Jesus is God. But we do worship the representatives of God. We wash their feet, we hear them, we give them things to eat, we take care of them. But they're not God, they're representatives of God. So there's a difference.
But they're still representatives of the same God. I mean, no matter what.
There's only one God, whether it's in Christianity or Mohammedanism or whatever it may be. Anyone who worships God, there's one God. The difference in Krishna consciousness is that there's systematic information of what God looks like, of God's personality, and his entourage, what he does, how he eats, how he looks, what he says, how we can reach him, how we can think of him. This is the difference. But there's one God. So Prabhupada's notion was, and he said this in the Western countries, that you just develop love for God. Whatever concept you have about, develop love for him. And if we can develop love for him, then gradually we will come to want to know more about who God is. Because love is based on knowledge. But there's one God, certainly. Just like there's only one Son. Yes, one more question.
On the topic of this Christianity, I just want to know, there are some great preachers and nuns and priests in Christianity. Aren't they not going back to Godhead? I know they are meditators, but they are praying to God, they are sacrificing their life in the church and doing service and everything. And then there are so many nice people I met, they are Christians. Are they not going back to Godhead?
There was a devotee in Moscow who was not. Yeah, maybe 18 or 19. He was lived in the temple for about a year. And I don't know if it was because he wanted to get out of the army or why, but he joined the Russian Orthodox Church. And he came to see me about a year later. And he grew his hair out a little bit. I think he had a girlfriend. Probably started with me. I don't know. I shouldn't say because I don't know. But he asked me, we had a kind of discussion. And he said, do you think I can go back to Godhead? As a Russian Orthodox priest. And my answer was, if you stop eating meat, then it will be possible. So, it's possible that such persons, if they stop committing these kinds of aparadhas, they can go if they have an inclination to love God and to worship God. But they must be purified. Krishna does not let anyone into the spiritual world if there's envy within his heart. And the seed of this envy is thinking that others may be exploited by me, that I'm superior to them. So it's possible, but the heart has to be completely cleansed. One has to become merciful. One has to become a Brahmin, which means all the good qualities, mercifulness, cleanliness, truthfulness, austerity, kindliness, compassion, etc. And then one has to become the Vaishnava. Then entrance will be granted into the spiritual world. So it is possible if through proper association, they get purified. And therefore, it's imperative that we were talking about Arpa Bhagavad the other day, that they get good association. They gradually get a taste for prasadam and gradually give up their bad habits. So it's a start. It's a good start. So, I think we'll end here. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam, Vijaya, Prabhupada.